You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 8th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London, and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Nancy Durham. On today's show,
we have a situation that again is deadlocked in a very bloody way. It seems like there is no way out, and it seems like the violence is really taking over all areas of Egypt.
From Cairo and Damascus to the U.S. Capitol, I'll take a whirlwind tour through the latest developments in the Middle East and Washington with Kathleen Burke and Stuart Purvis. Author Vic Gatrell will join us to explain the birth of the Bohemians in London's Golden Age. Later in the show, we're at the Monocle Cafe for coffee and conversation. Today, chef Vincent Ménage parses through the pleasures of traditional French goûter. All that plus music, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Nancy Durham, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour right here on Aperitivo. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
An elite U.S. interrogation team is continuing to question an alleged senior al-Qaeda figure seized in a raid in Libya at the weekend. Abu Anas al-Libi is being held on a Navy ship in the Mediterranean. Libya continues to demand an explanation of the special forces raid on its territory, but White House spokesman Jay Carney has defended the operation.
Abu Anas al-Libi has been indicted in the Southern District of New York in connection with his alleged role in al-Qaeda's conspiracy to kill U.S. nationals and to conduct attacks against U.S. interests worldwide, which included al-Qaeda plots to attack U.S. forces stationed in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Somalia, as well as the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya.
President Vladimir Putin has demanded an apology from the Netherlands today after Dutch police detained the Russian embassy's second-ranking diplomat at his home following a complaint by neighbors. Russia said Dmitry Borodin was badly beaten in front of his children by what it said were unidentified armed assailants and lodged a formal diplomatic protest over Saturday's incident today. The Dutch foreign ministry said the government would apologize if a police investigation found Borodin's right to diplomatic immunity under the Vienna Convention had been violated. Meanwhile, a Russian court has ordered a critic of Vladimir Putin to be incarcerated in a psychiatric ward over clashes with police at a protest, a ruling compared by human rights activists to Soviet-era abuses of psychiatry to jail dissidents. Mikhail Kosenko, who was treated as an outpatient for mental disorder before his arrest, is among more than two dozen accused of taking part in mass disorder at a protest on Moscow's Bolotnaya Square on the 6th of May 2012, the eve of Putin's inauguration to the presidency for a six-year term. President Obama has signaled he's willing to accept a short-term solution to stop the U.S. government running out of money during the federal shutdown. If debt limits aren't raised within 10 days, it could cause an even bigger financial crisis than the budget dispute that's seen hundreds of thousands of federal workers forced to take unpaid leave. Well, Ralph Sanchez, the Daily Telegraph's Washington correspondent, says both sides are still expecting the other to back down.
The White House's assumption has always been that the public will blame Republicans for the shutdown and that sooner or later the GOP will crumble under pressure and give in and reopen the government. So far, the polls show that the public are blaming Republicans more than they're blaming the White House. But as yet, that pressure hasn't reached the critical stage yet.
Nepal's only billionaire is considering a move into politics. Binod Chaudhary made his fortune selling instant noodles before moving into banking, telecoms and setting up dozens of resorts. Now he's thinking about a run for office.
I'm convinced that this country needs a leadership which understands business, which understands the importance of creating a prosperous country, who keeps the politics on side or channelizes the politics to achieve that goal.
And finally, China has sacked an official for extravagant waste after he spent an estimated 1.6 million yuan, that's $260,000, on a lavish three-day wedding for his son, according to state media today. The latest move in a crackdown on excessive lifestyles and graft. Ma Lin Shi, a deputy village chief from Beijing, hosted the estimated 250-table wedding at a convention centre that was part of the main 2008 Beijing Olympics venue during the week-long National Day holiday last week. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley there. Thank you very much for bringing us the latest in wedding news there.
250-table event costing $260,000.
Quite a, I bet there were wonderful party bags going with that.
And maybe a few glasses of champagne, I think.
I think so too. I like the noodle man from Nepal. Look forward to hearing more about him too.
Yeah, that was quite fun.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Nancy.
You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We'll be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo, and the time here in London right now is 6 minutes past 6 o'clock in the evening, and it's 13:06 in the afternoon in New York. Well, joining me now with their take on the news, we have two studio guests, Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London. Kathleen writes about Anglo-American relations and many other things, including wine and its history. And Stuart Purvis, good to see you again. Thanks for coming back. Professor of Television Journalism at City University. Welcome to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice. I think one of my challenges today is going to be to get Kathleen to bring the wine testing and tasting somehow into the conversation.
You give me a glass and I'll be happy to do it.
Okay. Well, hello, my producer. We'll work on that. Anyway, thanks so much for coming in. And as I said, we're going to do a bit of a walk around the Middle East with you today, starting with Libya and the American raid, which led to the capture of al-Qaeda leader Anas al-Libi. But before we get started on that chat, let's hear a little bit from Richard Barrett, former head of the al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations. We asked him what this raid says about al-Qaeda's regional presence.
The leadership of al-Qaeda has advised its supporters to sort of establish themselves where they can, not necessarily by committing acts of violence, but by trying to gain support and building safe havens. That's sort of the push, if you like. And the pull is that several groups in areas of North Africa, of sub-Saharan Africa, and indeed, of course, with Al-Shabaab in East Africa and Boko Haram in West Africa, and some of these groups have looked to al-Qaeda to provide them with a sort of label of legitimacy, if you like to pretend that they're something bigger than they are. And so that has also helped al-Qaeda perhaps to pretend that it has a broadening presence through Africa, which may actually only be a broadening presence of violent extremist groups.
And I think we do have, listening to him there, a sense of al-Qaeda operatives being all over the place at the moment. Kathleen?
Well, I was just thinking that it may be little groups, but often little groups can get more access to do unpleasant things than large groups can. So I think that's probably a rather ridiculous comment to make.
Because they're under the radar somewhat, perhaps, Stuart? Or?
Well, I mean, if you take the words that sometimes uses the Al-Qaeda franchise, as the expert was saying, they get profile, if you like, being linked with the Al-Qaeda family, certainly get more coverage around the world from being linked with it. What the practical effect of that link is, I'm not really sure.
I mean, a real problem with it, of course, is that if you don't mind hurting people, you have power. You can exercise a power that many can't. I mean, if the idea is that if you're within line, you're going to get killed, that will have a wonderfully concentrating effect. That's one problem, you know.
So very few people can take over the shopping mall, as we saw the other day. Is that the kind of thing you're referring to?
Well, it's just also that people are afraid if they hold out against them, especially in the localities, they'll get killed. No question. So therefore, it's quite easy, I should have thought, to gain territory. You only have to threaten.
It was really striking when it was all over to realize how few people had been involved and how much damage had been caused, not actually by the Al-Qaeda-linked people, but actually by the Kenyan troops looting, for instance. So, I mean, it was a fairly salutary lesson in the power of fear, as you say, but also in you know, the ability of a relatively well-organized military force to counteract it.
So now, looking at Libya, jumping up north in Africa, the country's very unhappy about the snatching of this Al-Qaeda leader. They say they want to bring people to justice in their own country. The Americans say he's a, quote, legal target to take away, and now he's going to be facing justice in the States, it looks like. What about this move?
Well, it's extraterritoriality, isn't it? It's the Americans saying that anything that hurts them can be outside the local judiciary. I mean, the problem with telling the Libyan government it was going to happen was, of course, it would be leaky like a sieve. They would know it was going to happen. And the same way is that Libya is so disorganized, especially its judicial system, that it would be, I cannot imagine in any way that he will be returned to Libya to be tried.
Really ironic, if you look now, this is the second time that the United States has gone into a country allegedly friendly to effectively kidnap or bring out to justice a leading member of Al-Qaeda. In the case of Pakistan, it was the leader of Al-Qaeda,
Bin Laden
himself.
Right?
And now we have somebody in a country which, to be honest, the West sort of helped organize the revolution. And here we have to now go in to get somebody when the government was sort of meant to be on our side.
Well, don't forget Italy, of course. Several years ago, the CIA did the same thing, didn't they?
That's true, they did, yes.
Who did they take? You have to remind me, I'm afraid.
That's a good question.
Okay, I require notice of that question.
Notice of that question.
Well, okay.
But when you say they're angry about it, I just wonder if they kind of felt they had to be angry about it. Because there were rumours that actually there were Libyans involved and there may have been government complicity. But in terms of the outside world, the Libyan government had to look as though it was outraged at what had happened.
And the son of the man who was taken thinks it was Libyans who took him away. So I think a bit of theatricality is going on here.
Yeah. Mm.
At the same time, we had the Americans going into Somalia to try to get another suspected terrorist. They came out empty-handed. So it's been a busy week.
Well, the problem with Somalia, of course, or that particular one, was that there was huge gunfire back. And one thing that determines American activities, military activities, is force protection. You know, you will devastate everything around before you'll allow one of your own people to be hurt, and you never leave a body. So therefore, obviously, the return fire was so great that there was some danger. And then, of course, it turned out the chap wasn't there anyhow.
And you had the specter of, was it Black Hawk Down, the whole Somalia hanging over it. I mean, that movie itself, I know it's a movie, but you just kind of sense, you know, one crisis leading to another. So as you say, if perhaps even one person had been captured by Al-Shabaab, what would have happened then? They must have thought, let's get out of here now before this goes wrong.
I thought of Bin Laden right away, too, you know, the taking of him. You mentioned Italy. We need to investigate that further. And now we've got Libya. Is this old hat then on the Americans' part, or are we seeing a bit of a new trend?
I just think it means you can't trust your so-called allies. You can't trust them what you're going to do because it might leak. And even as you say in the case of Italy, I think it's reasonable. Some of these countries have a reputation for leaking. So if you want to actually bring them out by normal extradition processes, it's going to be extremely difficult. So I suppose that's the pragmatic justification for these interventions.
As a historian, I do feel I should point out this is not something new. The ice pick in Trotsky's neck in Mexico, for example. Right. The British were really good during most of the 19th and early 20th century doing this precise same thing, getting people out of Ottoman jails and so forth. But they didn't have the full media blare.
And of course, the Israelis went into Latin America and got Adolf Eichmann and took him back to Israel for trial. So,
loads of examples.
Yeah. Mm.
Let's move, if we could, now to Egypt, speaking of old allies and so on, which has seen a rise in violence over the past several days. We talked earlier with Rachel Shawby, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Here's what she had to say about the recent developments in Cairo.
demonstrations that were supposed to commemorate the 40-year anniversary of the Arab-Israeli 73 war with Israel rapidly deteriorated into violence when Muslim Brotherhood and their supporters decided that that would be a good time, for some reason, to reassert opposition to the military and the transitional government that followed the coup and the ouster of their democratically elected Islamist president. So in that context, of course, there was a bloody showdown on Sunday. And yesterday we saw sort of reprisal attacks against police and security forces, car bombings and drive-by shootings. So we have a situation that, again, is deadlocked in a very bloody way. It seems like there is no way out. And it seems like the violence is really taking over all areas of Egypt.
Stuart and Kathleen, to you both, is there no way out?
Well, could I say two things? First of all, it seems to me it's a 2.5 war here. You have the military, but you have two divergent groups, the Islamist militants and the Brotherhood, which isn't necessarily, doesn't necessarily fight, you know, with arms, as it were. And those two are partly conflating in a way that wasn't happening before. So you could knock down the Brotherhood, but then you've still got the Islamists coming out from the north of the country. But it's quite obvious there's no end game. It just goes up and up and up and up. And everyone bleats that there must be political dialogue, but who are you going to talk to and what are you going to talk about?
Yes, there's reports today that in parts of Sinai now it amounts to a full-scale insurgency. And I guess that is just going to grow in different parts of Egypt. And so far, of course, the south, from which a lot of tourist revenue is derived from people going on sort of boat trips down the Nile, that's been relatively unaffected. But I wonder how long that's going to stay the same, and then the impact on the prosperity of Egypt. It's an extremely grim situation and almost echoes of Syria in the sense that it started in pockets and then somehow just grew and grew. And it's a very interesting point you make about the Brotherhood. I mean, the Brotherhood has existed for decades.
90 years.
90 years. And sure, there have been terrorist incidents in that time, but it's never been a military force in that sense. But now it's, by force of circumstance, almost merged into a jihadist-type organization.
But it does sound absolutely impossible and hopeless, but can we think out of that box in some way? If only something could happen. It does seem desperately hopeless, but you must have ideas.
we would be much richer, Stuart and I, if we could come
set up
with
a consultancy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, the point is each one thinks they're going to negotiate from force, from top. And as long as they can still damage each other. I mean, this is an obvious, banal thing to say, but someone has to decide that the cost is too high. And what's quite clear is that no one has come anywhere near deciding the cost is too high.
So if we can't fix Egypt this afternoon, let's turn to Afghanistan, where nominations for president in the April elections have just closed with 22 candidates on the list. Karzai's term ends in April, so he's out of the running, though his older brother, Qaim Karzai, has signed up. So has Abdul Rasul Sayaf, one-time friend of Osama bin Laden and a man Human Rights Watch says is responsible for war crimes in the 90s. The Taliban doesn't recognize the election process and has told people not to vote. So how do the candidates and the electoral system look for Afghanistan?
One thing that's really interesting, I think, that hasn't been mentioned there, I mean, obviously, Karzai's elder brother, Qaim, and so forth, but one of the equivalent of vice presidential candidates is Rostrum, of course, who has been, for 20 years, the predominant Uzbekistan warlord in the north. And what's interesting is he's decided to try to go for politics and decided which candidate he was going to go along with, and has gone along with Ghani, as you know. There will be an election. Will it matter? Something will emerge which will give the West a reason to withdraw without too much egg on the face. But the difference it's going to make to Afghanis themselves seems to be a very desperate situation.
And Stuart, Karzai has not gone yet, but he's been beginning his set piece, final interviews. He was on the BBC the other night saying that NATO caused Afghanistan a lot of suffering, a lot of loss of life, and no gains because the country's not secure. His parting words.
I suppose if it hadn't been for NATO, he wouldn't have got the job in the first place. So it's
good
sort
point.
Of slightly odd for him to be saying that. But he's now saying, of course, that you know the Taliban might end up, you know, in the government potentially, something he was had as completely criticised NATO for even thinking of at one point when they were talking to the Taliban. It's going to make it extremely difficult to make this, I was about to say the word retreat, but I suppose I should call it a withdrawal, as elegant as possible when the man we put in place is sort of saying, well, you know, thanks for nothing. I suspect both in the US and in the UK where, you know, the families of soldiers who've died are kind of just again asking themselves what exactly was the point of it. And I think the point you made about how we got here in terms of the warlords, I mean, I think if we look back at it, I think we kidded ourselves that somehow the people that overthrew the Taliban were some kind of democratic force, when of course it was a group of warlords that we, the West, had got together and organised and actually from representing a particular part of Afghanistan and certainly not the south of Afghanistan where we've lost so many lives, the British and American troops. So a difficult situation.
I mean, one little point might be useful to remember when you talk about the Taliban. There's Taliban and Taliban. I mean, there are various villages who hire out their chaps, as it were, and some of them will be Taliban for a while and some won't. So what I'm saying is they are not all necessarily bloodthirsty, knife-carrying people, if you see what I mean, because they're really the Pashtun. The Taliban's are really the Pashtun, the largest tribe in Afghanistan, and policymakers forget that. So in that sense, they feel they ought to rule. They ruled for 300 years, you know. So I think possibly there is room for some negotiation.
Okay, and I'm going to, the minutes are flying by. We've got tape. I'm going to miss one clip and go ahead, march us ahead to Syria, if I can. Little bit of good news. U.S. Secretary Kerry had something positive to say about Syria as the first of the chemical weapons were destroyed. He said, quote, it's a credit to the Assad regime and a good beginning. And I've got a clip now of Dr. Patricia Lewis, nuclear physicist and arms control expert at Chatham House in London, on the actual experts on the ground there in Syria dealing with this.
Very quietly, very consistently, there has been an organization being set up in The Hague from the mid-90s that has the whole team of experts doing this all the time. And they're not, the experts themselves don't dismantle the chemical weapons, but they supervise the dismantling by experts within the countries that have them. For example, Russia and the United States still have significant stocks of chemical weapons left over from the Cold War, and they are in the process day by day being dismantled. So this is well understood. The people that they can bring in work with the OPCW all the time. The people within the OPCW, which stands for the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, know how to supervise, how to monitor, how to plan. They are all experts in this, and they're from all over the world. They're not, you know, just experts from America or Russia. They're from Arab countries. They're from Latin American countries, Asian countries, and so on.
Little glimpse there from the ground in Syria. Just quick thoughts before we move on to our next topic. Kathleen, first, or Stuart, either one of you on Syria.
Look, they're doing a fantastic job, but at the end of the day, chemical warfare accounted for 2% of the deaths. So it's not going to make an enormous difference to the scale of the suffering.
Also, one should remember that the chemicals themselves are across the country in at least 45 different places, so that it will be easier to rebuild the systems to send them, even if they can't actually necessarily manufacture the gas. I don't think it's going to mean it's going to end necessarily.
Okay, we're going to take a very short break now. You're listening to Aperitivo here with me, Nancy Durham, my guests Kathleen Burke and Stuart Purvis. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about wine and American politics.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavor has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
the opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
And this is Aperitivo right here on Monocle 24. Still with me, my guests, Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Stuart Purvis, Professor of Television Journalism at City University London. And as we said at the top of the show, Kathleen is something of a very serious wine buff, the daughter of a
grape farmer.
A grape farmer. And a bottle has appeared in the studio, and you've decanted or opened it. What is it and how is it?
Well, it's a Sicilian white wine. It's actually quite good. I mean, Sicilian white wine tended to be a close relative of paint thinner. But over the past several years, it's improved immeasurably. I mean, this isn't something that's going to go into the books as the great white wine. But it's made from local grapes. It's very refreshing. It's very nice. And I think, may I say, this is one of the more civilized programs in which I've been a part of to actually have a glass of wine.
Well, I've got such civilized company here with me, and I did think a show with a name like Aperitivo ought to have a tot or two. So this is great. And I suppose in Washington these days, various people are falling onto wonderful bottles of California wine or whatever as they sort of come to terms with the mess they're in. It's 1 week down in the shutdown.
It is just amazing, is it not? It shows how much it's in a bubble. The idea that it's impossible to actually say right, you know, yes or no to whether you're going to let a budget through or whether you're, or anything of this sort. That, well, what can I say? I was born an American and I'm now both over here, and I sit over here and I wonder, do they not realize? And then you realize that a lot of the people in the House of Representatives, the Republicans, don't think there is going to be much of a change if we cannot pay the debts. That they're so disconnected from a reality outside of Washington or even out of the United States, which is a profoundly insular country, that they don't think if it does happen, it's not going to matter. And if it does happen and it matters, it's not going to matter to them. What matters is getting Obamacare off.
And Stuart, you're sitting here British watching across the pond.
Yes, there was one interesting interview on British television where one of the British interviewers said to one of the leaders in the House, are you feeling pleased with yourself? And the answer to that was, well, this happens all the time over here. You know, what's the big deal? And kind to a European audience, this is just kind of unfathomable. I mean, you know, sure, we have our Greeces and our Italies that have odd troubles with balancing their budgets and their debts from time to time. But it gets us back to the constitutional balance that was built in, you know, in the early days, based, of course, on as a reaction against being a British colony. And I suppose it's, you know, to us to think we don't even have a proper constitution, so who are the Brits to talk? But if we look at the way it's structured, it just doesn't entirely make sense. It looks as though it's overcompensating for the power of the executive going back centuries, when maybe there must be a better way of doing it. But I don't ever hear any suggestions of constitutional reform, because presumably that would be a heretical suggestion.
To get constitutional reform, you would have to get the reform passed through both houses of Congress, two-thirds majorities, and two-thirds majorities in three-quarters of the state legislatures. That's why there's only been 18 amendments in the past several hundred years. Yeah. I mean, the problem was, you're quite right, the idea was checks and balances, so that you've got a house that has senators are elected for 6 years, but the House of Reps are only elected for 2 years. And the founding fathers, their whole point was to reflect local opinion. That was the whole point of it. But they also thought there would be negotiation. They didn't think there was going to be slamming the door, bolting it up and saying, nah, 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 is the problem. So that it's not, it was supposed to be negotiation, not negation, I guess we could say.
Yeah, but that does seem to go to the heart of it. And I understand now why it's so difficult to change it, because I just can't see how you could get that through all those different legislatures.
No,
and it's frightening, obviously, I mean, to everybody, I think, in a way, watching. Like, you're on the outside looking back, sort of on the outside, and you're asking, can't they see? And evidently,
well, I think
some of them can't.
I mean, some of them do say that, oh, this has happened 12 times before. And it's true, there was a few little shutdowns, but they happened over a weekend, you know, and things were fine again by Monday, you know. And the last time it was tried, you know, under Clinton with Newt Gingrich, what happened was that the Republican majority was wiped out of the House. Now, why do they not see this as a precedent and what might happen to them? That's what I really don't understand.
They do seem to be changing the argument a little. The you know, whereas Obamacare was the big issue, now they're talking about the debt ceiling rather more than the Obamacare. And I think the president's actually due to say something and, you know, do a press conference quite soon. But because he's taking a very hard line as well, as the Republicans, yes, would say it. So again, that's difficult. There's absolutely no mood for compromise at all.
Well, as executive, he has taken his oath, you know, to support the full faith and credit, as it does say in the Constitution. And so what will be interesting is see if talk develops over the next several days as to what the president can actually do legally to circumvent.
And sadly, we have to leave it there. But with a great big thank you to both of you, Kathleen Burke and Stuart Purvis, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us here in Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come, then, in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Café to talk French cuisine, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Nancy, thank you very much. An elite US interrogation team is continuing to question an alleged senior al-Qaeda figure seized in a raid in Libya at the weekend. Abu Anas al-Libi is being held on a Navy ship in the Mediterranean. Libya continues to demand an explanation of the special forces raid on its territory. President Vladimir Putin has demanded an apology from the Netherlands today after Dutch police detained the Russian embassy's second-ranking diplomat at his home following a complaint by neighbours. Russia said Dmitry Borodin was badly beaten in front of his children by what it said were unidentified armed assailants and has lodged a formal diplomatic protest. Meanwhile, a Russian court has ordered a critic of Vladimir Putin to be incarcerated in a psychiatric ward over clashes with police and a protest, a ruling compared by human rights activists to Soviet-era abuses of psychiatry to jail dissidents. And President Obama has signalled he's willing to accept a short-term solution to stop the US government running out of money during a federal shutdown. If debt limits aren't raised within 10 days, it could cause an even bigger financial crisis than the budget dispute that's seen hundreds of thousands of federal workers forced to take unpaid leave. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan Wheatley there with the news. Well, you are listening to Aperitivo live here on Monocle 24. And if you're listening live, it's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London. And in fact, it's just about to strike 1500. Oh dear, I've blown that. 1433 in Rio de Janeiro. Well, it's time now to head to the Monocle Café on nearby Chiltern Street for a bit of coffee and conversation. On today's show, we meet Vincent Ménage, the celebrated executive chef at Sofitel, St. James, London. The Balcon restaurant there is launching a new offering from Pierre Hermé this week. So today, Vincent joins us to talk through the traditional French goûter. Vincent, right now, is with Marcus Hippie, the brains and voice behind Monocle's food and drink show, The Menu. Hi, Marcus. Over to you.
Hello, Nancy. Thank you for the beautiful words. Indeed, here at the Monocle Café, I'm joined by Vincent Ménage, the executive chef at Sofitel St. James Hotel, and it's the Bacot restaurant. Vincent, it is all very French, in particular, as at the same time, what we are talking about now is a collaboration with the world-famous French pastry chef Pierre Hermé. But to start from the very basics, the Brits have an afternoon tea, French have goûter, and this is what you are going to be offering at the Bacot restaurant. What is the difference between goûter and an afternoon tea?
Well, good evening. The goûter basically is something that we will have as a children coming back from school. It's something that will be mostly sweets, and most of the time will be sweet. We don't mix sweet and savory. And something that doesn't really exist for adults. It's really much an expression of bringing back the childhood for adults.
So is the Barco restaurant going to bring Gute for grown-ups as well?
Absolutely.
So what's coming up?
Well, we have, for the next 3 weeks, coming up two different offers, something which is Mogador, called the Gute Mogador, which is something based on traditional flavors from Pierre-Armé, which is milk, chocolate and passion fruit. It comes onto the same plate, a brioche, homemade brioche, a jam which is made from pineapple and orange, four different macaroons and four different chocolate bonbons. And the second offer is a chocolate goûter, very decadent, called Quatre Heures, which is made from two different chocolate cakes with ganache, flavored ganache with raspberries or confit lemon, confit grapefruit or passion fruit. Six chocolate sablés, which are a little bit flavored with fleur de sel from Guérande, from Brittany. And again, brioche and a chocolate and hazelnuts spread, which is absolutely gorgeous.
How close is that to what, say, you used to get as a child when you had your own goûté?
Well, my childhood goûté were very much slices of bread with some butter and chocolate, or could have been just a traditional cookie out of packets, or my grandmother would have made me a slice of country bread with rillettes on it, pork rillettes, because she was from Normandy and it was what was children having. But it's very different. Very much what we are doing now is something gentrified for adults.
And what is interesting is that what this collaboration means is that you've obviously been working with Pierre-Armé, and he was here in London today, and he was basically telling you how to do these things. What did you learn today?
Well, we have been in Paris learning how to make the brioche and the chocolate cake, because it's something that we can't get out of his shop here in London. Then he taught us how to make it the proper way. A brioche is a brioche, but a beautiful brioche is something different. This is what we learned from him, like special techniques and making sure that things are made right. The chocolate cake was something that he was selling in Paris in his shops, which doesn't now. Which now we are making for this event, which they are absolutely fantastic, and all the cakes, when you try them, you can find really much the different flavors. What we learned from him was that when you do something, if you do it with passion, you have a product at the end which is absolutely fantastic, and this is what he does with all his product, and what he's selling all together is really a passion and beautiful product and an experience.
It's interesting to talk about Pierre-Armé, considering how world famous he is and everything he has achieved during his career. You actually said to me before the beginning of this interview that it was interesting to learn from him how to do things very well. I assume that considering where you are in your career, you've actually learned to do things very well as well. But what is the difference?
Well, I'm a chef. I'm not a pastry chef. Then I did work in pastry in my young age. What I prefer, I prefer savory, but really, the pastry basically turn around recipes and techniques. And the recipe, if you have a fantastic recipe and you do it, you know, properly, controlling the temperature, the time that the dough is mixed, and the temperature of the oven, and the way everything is controlled, this is what makes a difference in between something which is basic and something which is beautiful.
So indeed, starting from tomorrow, Sofitel St. James Hotel's Barco restaurant is going to be offering this very highly developed version of Gute. I could imagine that, considering that London is the fifth biggest French city in the world, the French community over here is quite excited.
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of French people will come to see what it's all about, and I hope that English people will be interested as well and come and try this new thing.
Vincent Ménager, thank you very much for this. And now back to Nancy.
Thank you, Marcus. That was Marcus Hippie with Vincent Ménager, executive chef at Sofitel St. James, London. Up next, we'll find out where the age of the Bohemian all began. Stay tuned to this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
You are listening to Aperitivo with me, Nancy Durham. What and who do you think of when you think of the first Bohemians? Parisian poets and painters, liberal values, little money but lots to drink, perhaps? Well, author Vic Gatrell's book, The First Bohemians, says the first Bohemians were pre-Victorian English. They made up what he calls a creative community without equal in history, and they were all crammed into London's Covent Garden. Vic Gatrell is on the line from Cambridge, where he's a life fellow of Caius College. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, this is a really interesting looking book. I've had fun looking through it this afternoon. I wondered if I could ask you to start by painting a picture of what Covent Garden looked like in the age of the Bohemians, and also when that was.
Okay, well, you're a century out. You said it's Victorian. Actually, that's the 19th century. We're going back to the 1700s. And although Covent Garden today, you know, is a kind of buzzy territory, it's mainly commercialized and touristified in a way that it wasn't in the 1700s. It's the pattern of the streets are the same, but the buildings are all Georgian, remember. The traffic's much lighter. But the extraordinary thing is that in this square quarter mile, there's something like 200 artists living cheek by jowl, along with novelists, dramatists, poets, as well as the prostitutes and courtesans that everybody's heard about in the 18th century. It's a very vibrant, difficult, tense, sometimes violent, but also creative community.
Reading bits and pieces, I get a sense of it being a very vibrant, very wild, wicked place, lots of booze, huge amount of sex going on, but also next to death, a very smelly, dirty place as well.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, pre-modern London is not a place most of us would be comfortable with. It would be a third world city in many ways, full of rubbish and piles of shit and sewers and so on, and very smelly indeed, and foggy and smoky and pretty bad for the health altogether.
But still, yeah. A huge drawing card for people like Hogarth, the painter, Voltaire, Handel, Haydn, Mozart. They were from all over the UK and far, far away. They were drawn there for some reason.
Yes, well, it's something to do with the fact that the city, the old city, has become mercantile. The West End is slowly growing, but that's incredibly aristocratic and upmarket and gentrified. The old town, as they used to call it, around Soho and all the way across to Drury Lane and even Lincoln's Inn Fields, is where the life is since the 17th century. And the heart of it is the piazza, as they called it then, of Covent Garden, which is where the market is now, the converted market, of course, which is now the tourist paradise. So it is the town. It is where the theatres are, above all, Drury Lane and Covent Garden and the Haymarket. These are the theatres that are pulling in the courtesans, the prostitutes, but also the gentry and the young men on the make and on the razzle dazzle and the rakes and so on, to whom the artists and the poets and the novelists are catering, if you see what I mean.
The infrastructure. I guess. Sorry? The infrastructure.
Yes, I mean, I think almost indispensable to the liveliness and creativity of what we call 18th century culture, Georgian culture, is this razzmatazz, chaos, disorder, deep intimacy of the classes and of the types of people in the town around Covent Garden that generates Hogarth and the great artists like Hogarth onto Rowlandson, Fielding the novelist. They're feeding off the vibrancy of this very intimate community whose intimacy we've forgotten today.
It's just fascinating to imagine all of this and the people going there being like Covent Garden as a magnet. Do you know, do we understand why people came in the first place? I mean, did they love the buildings, the architecture, the style, and it just gradually became a place for people to meet?
No, I think it's mainly because it's affordable for the incoming poor, the people who are walking to London from vast distances. Samuel Johnson, for example, and Garrick, the great actor and the theatre manager, came from Lichfield on horseback, but they had only one horse. So one rode a couple of miles, tethered the horse and walked on. The other caught up, got on the horse and so on. And they did this curious walk. And they were aiming for Covent Garden. Johnson lived in Exeter Street. He ended up there with 2.5 pennies in his pocket, he claimed. And he lodged where as cheaply as he could, where there was still, nonetheless, although it was cheap and rowdy, there was enough talent in the coffee houses and the taverns for him to hope for a future as a literary man. So it's the dynamism of the place that's pulling them in, as well as the affordability of it.
Why do you think we have this rather misimpression that the Bohemians begin in Paris up in an artist's garret? Mm. Why is that?
Well, I think the word is a French term. It's it's coined in the 1840s by Mergier in his La Vie Bohémienne, in his novel of that name, and it survives, I think, as a kind of attribute of Parisian left bank and Montmartre and so forth. And it's also acted upon by the French young Turks, if you want to call them that, you know, the poets taking lobsters for walks in the Tuileries Gardens on a leash. That kind of thing is a posture. There's a huge cultural posture on the part of the French in the 18th century. By comparison, in Covent Garden and in this quarter mile square, they don't have to pretend to be odd or poor or impoverished or sexually free. Sexual freedom is a characteristic of the 18th century. So it's not so much that they're shocking the bourgeoisie, as the later Bohemians tended to do, and did all the way through, of course, into the days of Soho in the 20th century. But it's that they're just living on their wits, on their talents, their wenching, they're boozing, they're gambling. It's a very low life. We have an idea of the 18th century as a territory in which people are powdered and smart and polite to each other and bowing and scraping and so forth. Actually, they're earthier than we are. They were earthier than we are.
Okay, but I think we need to wrap, but I want to just ask you very quickly, if I can, is there a Bohemian capital or headquarters in the world today?
I can't think of one to compare with Covent Garden, or for that matter, Soho. I can't think of one. There was, I suppose, in Greenwich Village in the 1960s and 70s, a kind of hippie Soho, if you like. But I think we're dealing with a big cosmopolitan culture now, and a highly corporate one, where that kind of bohemianism has been knocked out of the window.
Thanks so much. That was Vic Gatrell, author of The First Bohemians, Life and Art in London's Golden Age.
I'm from China.
Scotland.
France.
Paris.
I come from Italy. I'm Barcelona.
Spain. Ireland.
We are from Poland.
Holland.
Nice tune there, Murrow with Bohemian. Well, you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're fast coming to the end of the program. But before we go, I'm delighted to say I've been joined by two of my delightful colleagues. They've come down into the studio, and they're very delightful. Emma Nelson, who is going to be presenting Globalist Asia later tonight at 8 o'clock, and Barbara Feeney, who will be producing the Monocle Daily at 10 o'clock. So, ladies, welcome.
Hello, Nancy.
To the woman's
I must confess, I did like that last piece of music. It was very aperitivo-esque.
Wasn't it lovely?
It was delightful. So I could hear the glasses tinkling in the background. You want to know what's in our programme, don't you?
I'd like to know what you're going to be talking about.
We're going to be talking to Aisha Spears, who's in Bali, mopping up at APEC. We've been talking about how, in the last couple of days, how Obama's absence has sort of changed the direction of APEC, and how some of the countries are looking to China now, as opposed to the United States, because of the great absence of Barack Obama. Today we're going to look at one of the countries which stands to gain the most, which is in fact the host nation, Indonesia. Bali saw itself get a brand new airport and new transport infrastructure. The plaster was still a bit wet at the airport when Aisha arrived, but by all accounts this is the opportunity for Indonesia to get more investment. And people are saying that, and Indonesia itself is saying that apparently investment in their country is, and I'm quoting, addictive. So we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. We'll also be staying in the region somewhat by looking at how China and Japan are now beginning to express their worries about the state of the parlous state of both financial and political affairs in Washington. The Chinese have warned Washington not to risk their investments in the country. And Japan is saying that if the United States defaults on its debt ceiling on the 17th of October, this could have calamitous effects on its currency, because if the dollar drops, the yen goes up and Japan is back in the same problem it had before. Plus, Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, winging his way to the airport in Stockholm. He's going to be on the line with me. I'm going to do an interview in just a few moments' time. He's been talking to the Swedish Prime Minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt, and he's also been, I don't know where else he's been. Oh, he's been talking to Ollie Zachrisson. Any regular listener of The Globalist on Monocle 24 will know that we talked to Ollie quite a lot from Svenska Dagbladet to find out what's going on there. So that's all coming up in a little over an hour's time.
Is that all? Wow.
That's honestly, just the first half.
Powerhouse. Not horse, powerhouse.
Powerhouse. Thank you, Barbara.
Don't go. Stay. Barbara Feeney, can you
compete? Hello, Nancy.
Can you top that? Your program will be 2 hours later, 10 o'clock tonight, London time, Monocle Daily. What have you got?
Yes. So first off, we are in the States, where we're going to speak to a man who says that we've lost sight of what this whole shutdown is about. He says that, you know, we're just kind of focusing on the petty spat between the Republicans and the Democrats. So we're going to talk to him. Then we are in Rio, where there's been some teachers protest. There's been some
riots.
Teachers who've been striking, and the protests yesterday who were supporting the teachers, you know, it's turned violent. So we're going to talk to our woman there. And then we are going to Argentina, because the Argentinian president, Cristina Kirchner, is unwell at the moment. And quite a contentious figure is going to replace her while she's kind of taking a month off. So we're going to ask, you know, are people... what do people think about that? And, you know, how, you know, do we expect to see Kirchner back in a month?
Good.
Yeah.
And I want to hear that man explain what the American shutdown's all about. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting
interpretation
discussion.
Required.
In what way are they going to be asking? I think it's me who's going to be asking the questions. I've got to work out. We're going to probably be asking out what it actually constitutes as a shutdown, because I know that when we've been talking to experts in the last couple of weeks, they've all been saying that the trickle effect hasn't got down yet. It's all not been, you can't really feel it yet.
Yeah.
And as it happens,
That's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. Thanks so much for joining us just now. My thanks in particular, too, to our studio guests, Kathleen Burke from University College London and Stuart Purvis from City University London, who talked us through the latest news developments in the Middle East and America. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Furmanish and Maddie Arouge. Our studio manager was Bill Luthi. Next up is Section D, and continuing our autumn design show coverage, we'll be paying a visit to Toronto's International Interior Design Exposition.
If you have an opportunity like this, let's push it. Let's invent new technologies, or at least take existing technologies and see how far we can push them.
At 2000 hours London time, we'll have Globalist Asia, and then at 2200, the Monocle Daily will air. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, goodbye from me, Nancy Durham, and thanks for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.